I want to take up in volume three and begin at January the 22nd, 1900. And this is about our response to grace. After going through most bitter days of privation, Louisa said, my poor heart was struggling between the fear of having lost Jesus and the hope that, who knows, I might see him again. Oh God, what a bloody war this poor heart of mine has to bear. The pain is so great that how now at one stage it would be ice cold and then it would be squeezed as though under a press and would drip blood. While I was in this state, I felt my sweet Jesus near me. He removed a veil from me which prevented me from seeing him. So finally, I was able to see him. Immediately, I said to him, ah, Lord, you don't love me anymore. Now, when Louisa gives this kind of response to Jesus, it's very personal and it's to do with these awful privations that she has to learn how to cope with. If you put beside this Jeremiah 31:3, where God says, I have loved you with an everlasting love and my love is constant. It never changes. But Louisa has to learn how to deal with this privation. Jesus said, yes, yes, what I recommend to you is response to my grace. And in order to be faithful, you must be like the echo that resounds in an empty space. Now, the significant thing here is the empty space, because throughout these writings, Jesus tells us that the only safe place for us to be in if we want to grow spiritually and we want God to work in us and produce fruit in us is that we must sink into our nothingness, that we must be utterly and completely convinced of our nothingness. And the more we stay in the nothingness, the more he can work with us. So he said, you must be like an echo that resounds in an empty space. As soon as a voice is emitted immediately, without the slightest hesitation, one can hear the echo booming after it. In the same way, as soon as you begin to receive my grace, without even waiting for me to finish giving it, begin immediately the echo of your response. So he's asking for a heroic correspondence to grace here from Louisa. And I want to give you 2 Corinthians 12:9, in case you think it's impossible, which it is. My grace is sufficient for you. My power works best in weakness. So we don't have any excuse. We only have to throw ourselves on the Lord. So January 27th, 1900. And this speaks about the order of the virtues in the soul. Louisa says, I continue to be almost without my sweet Jesus. My life is leaving me because of the pain. I feel such tedium, boredom and tiredness of life. Now, if you understand that she's sitting in a bed doing nothing, you will understand that when she says she's suffering from tedium and boredom and tiredness of life, that is probably an understatement. I would go mad if I was in her position. So Louisa said, I kept saying in my interior, oh, how my exile has been prolonged. Oh, what happiness would be mine if I could loosen the bonds of my body so that my soul might take wing and fly towards its highest good. Now that's Psalm 55. Oh, that I had the wings of a dove, I would fly away and be at rest. Of course, Louisa is not going to die until 1947. She's another 47 years to go. So she has to get used to this privation. A thought said to me, and what if you go to hell? And Louisa, so as not to call the devil to fight me, she said, immediately snapped out of it by saying, well then, even from hell, I would send my sighs to my sweet Jesus. And even from there, I'd love him. Now, that's a direct response from the last message I've just given you, in which Jesus said your response to grace must be immediate. And so here she says, I snapped out of it quickly. She realized it was a temptation. So while I was amid these and other thoughts, she said, the story would be too long. if I told you the whole lot. Beloved Jesus made himself seen for just a little, and with the serious aspect he told me, your time has not yet come. For that I want to give you John 2:4 and John 7:6, when Jesus said of himself, my hour has not yet come. So if the hour hasn't come, Louisa has to learn how to penetrate the meaning of this privation and make the most of it. Then with an intellectual light, he made me understand that everything must be orderly in the soul. This intellectual light is called infused knowledge. It comes directly from him. The soul possesses many little apartments, this infused knowledge told her, in which each virtue takes its place, even though it can be said that one single virtue contains all the others within itself, and that the soul, by possessing only one of them, comes to be endowed with them all. However, in spite of this, they are all distinct. So much so that each of them has its own place in the soul. And here is how the virtues have their origin in the mystery of the Most Holy Trinity. While the Most Holy Trinity is one, there are three distinct persons, and while they are three, they are one. Louisa said, I also understood that these apartments in the soul are either full of virtue or full of vice, the opposite of that virtue. And if there is neither virtue nor vice, the soul is empty, of a terrible emptiness. It seems to me that they are like a house. The soul is like a house which contains many rooms, all empty. Now, Jesus said in John 14, verses 1 and 2, in my Father's house there are many rooms, and there's one for you. But here the Lord is showing us that inside of our own soul there are many rooms. And Louisa said she saw that some of the rooms were full of snakes, some of mud. Mud usually means earthiness and filthiness and that kind of stuff. Some were full of pieces of furniture, full of dust, and some were dark. Ah, Lord, she said, you alone can put my poor soul in order. You can see, therefore, that if the rooms have snakes and mud and furniture full of dust, that we have to go and get involved in fighting the good fight. So for this, I want to give you 1 Timothy 6:12. This is why we have to fight the good fight and conquer the kingdom that is within us. We have 2 Timothy 4:7. We have Hebrews 10 verses 32 to 35. And Hebrews 11:37. But I also want to remind you of a lady called Elizabeth Wang. She was a convert to Catholicism, and the Lord gave her a wonderful gift of painting the mysteries of our faith. And you can find them all on radiantlight.org. And one of these paintings is of a good soul receiving Holy Communion. I don't know what you would paint if somebody asked you to paint somebody receiving Holy Communion. Would you paint them on the outside receiving Holy Communion on the tongue? No, she painted the soul like a womb. And Jesus was sitting on the edge of the soul, looking in with a perplexed expression on his face. Because while the soul had received him, there wasn't any room for him. Now, this wasn't a bad person, but the soul was full of all kinds of junk. And she painted the junk as, you know, boxes, some of them thin and some of them thick and some of them tall and small and square and round and all the rest of it. But they were filling the soul. And these are all the useless things that we allow to clog up our lives. And that's why we were told in volumes 1 and 2, and we will continue right through to volume 5, that the Lord will say to us, listen, this is my language, not his. You've got to get rid of the junk out of your life if you're to make room for God. Okay, that's my language. Okay, so if you've got snakes, you've got to get rid of them. If you've got mud, you've got to clean up. If you've got pieces of furniture full of dust, well, Do you even want the furniture? Do you need it? And so we must fight the good fight. So in all of these early volumes, we are being told that if we don't get our act together spiritually, you cannot live the phenomenon and the prodigy of the divine will. It's not possible. You wouldn't be ready. So you won't be surprised then that the next message in January 28, 1900 is about mortification. In other words, the cleanup. And we're going to have a number of messages about mortification as we go on. Louisa says it still continues the same way. This morning he transported me outside of myself. Now, usually I say to people that these are out of the body experiences, but the correct language would be that these are flights of the spirit, which St. John of the Cross speaks about very marvellously in his works. And Louisa has these flights of the spirit on a daily basis. After a long time, I seemed to see Jesus with clarity, she said. But I saw myself as so bad that I did not dare to utter a single word. Now, the woman who is saying this has already had three mystical marriages with God. So how can she use the expression so bad? Louisa is a very young person. She's Italian. She's very emotional. And sometimes this expression, she uses the word cattiva in Italian, which means you naughty little thing is the way it's used. And it's really a combination of where her feelings are at, where her emotions are at. It's not a statement of sin, because if it was a statement of sin, she could not be in the divine will. It's just that simple. 1 John 3:2. That those who are living in union with God don't sin. And this is going to be very, very, maybe 1 John 3:2-5. We have to become very, very clear about this. And that's why in the early volumes, we are told to go to war with sin. And if we don't go to war with sin, there is no divine will going to take over in us, because sin is horrific to God. So Louisa said she saw herself very bad. Now, the other way of explaining that too is that the closer we come to God, the more we see of the miseries of human nature. And those of us who have not had that vision don't see clearly. And I want to give you an example of that. One day I was driving in a car and it was a very dull, rainy day. And a big lorry overtook me because I wasn't travelling fast at the time and dumped all its mud on my windscreen. So no problem. I cleaned off the windscreen and continued driving. And I thought the windscreen was clean until the clouds parted, excuse me, and a ray of sunshine came through. And it was only as the light increased that I saw a thin layer of traffic film on the windscreen, which made it difficult to drive now. When it was dark and rainy, it didn't make it difficult to drive. But once you increased the light, yes, you could see more. And I had to work really hard to get this traffic film off. And then the windscreen was crystal clear and the light could come through and I could experience its warmth and its comfort and its acceptance of me and everything else. So as the saints get closer and closer to God, they become aware of that traffic film that we can't see because we're back in a darker place. So Louisa said, I saw Jesus with clarity. You see, the clarity is the light. And I saw myself as so bad, I didn't dare utter a single word, she said. We looked at each other, but in silence. That's contemplation. Through these mutual gazes, I understood that my good Jesus was filled with bitterness, but I didn't dare to say, pour them into me. He himself drew near and began to pour them, but unable to contain them, as I received them, I threw them on the ground. Now, Louisa knows we're in volume three. She knows that if she throws them on the ground, there's going to be chastisement. If she doesn't swallow them and suffer them, the chastisement won't be mitigated. So he said to me, "What are you doing? Do you not want to share in my bitterness anymore? You no longer want to give me relief in my pains?" And Louisa said, "Lord, this isn't my will. I myself don't know what has happened to me. I feel so full that I don't know where to contain them. Only a prodigy of yours can enlarge my interior so that I may receive your bitterness." So here is the Lord letting Louisa understand that for things that God wants to work in us, he has to increase our capacity to be able to receive what he's giving to us. And so he has to give us an experience of our nothingness, of our inability. So I want to give you John 15:5. "Without me, you can do nothing." And the more we go on spiritually, the more we are convinced about that. We can do nothing without him. So Louisa says, "Jesus marked me with the sign of the cross and he poured the bitterness again. So it seemed I was able to contain them. And then he said, 'My daughter, mortification is like fire that dries up all humours.'" Before I go on to that, I want to give you Philippians 4:13. We had just dealt with John 15:5 that without him I could do nothing. St. Paul says in Philippians 4:13, "But with Christ I can do all things." So before Jesus blessed her and enlarged her capacity, she couldn't do it. Afterwards, yes, she could. And then Jesus decided to enlighten her about mortification. Mortification, he said, is like fire that dries up the humours. Now, our dictionaries don't use the word humour anymore. It seems to include our moods and our emotions. You know the way we say, "I got out of bed and I was in a bad mood all day," and we don't even know why it happens. So he said that mortification deals with these bad moods. In the same way, mortification dries up these bad moods, which are present in the soul, and it inundates her with a sanctifying mood. In other words, the exact opposite to the bad mood is given to you in such a way as to make the most beautiful virtues sprout. Now, this is a very important piece of information, because there are days when we say we got out of the wrong side of the bed and we don't know what's wrong with us. And Jesus is telling us how to deal with it. So I want to give you 2 Corinthians 10 verses 4 to 5. Where St. Paul says that every thought must be captured and given to Christ. So we've got to take ourselves on. And it's only easy if you haven't tried it. So I want to continue with January the 31st, 1900. And so we're talking still about grace and its response. Because what you find in Louisa's writings is that once Jesus brings up a subject, he will develop it over a number of pieces. And before I even start, I want to give you a number of references to look up. Ephesians 2:8, 1 Peter 5:10, Romans 12:6, Ephesians 4:7 to 12, 1 Corinthians 15:10 and 2 Corinthians 9:8. That doesn't mean I've exhausted the references, but I think I've given you enough. So afterwards, Jesus came quite a few times, Louisa says, but always in silence. "I felt a void and a pain because I couldn't hear the most sweet voice of my Jesus. And he, coming back almost to content me, told me, 'Grace is the life of the soul. Just as the soul receives, gives life to the body, so does grace give life to the soul.'" Now, we know from volume two that Jesus said, "I am grace." Grace is the outpouring of God into us. Okay, so naturally, grace is the life of the soul. So just as the soul gives life to the body, so grace gives life to the soul. Without grace, we're dead. However, in order to have life, it's not enough for the body to have a soul. It also needs food. 2 Corinthians 6:1. It also needs food with which to nourish itself and to grow to the proper stature. Now that food is prayer, the Eucharist, and God's holy word. And I call them the proteins, carbohydrates, and fats of the spiritual life. In the same way, it's not enough for the soul to have grace in order to have life, but it needs food. Food is needed to nourish her and to raise her to the proper stature. Stature. That means your spiritual maturity. And what is this food? And here Jesus said, this food is your correspondence or your cooperation with grace. So, grace and the response we give to it form the links of the chain which lead the soul to heaven. And according to the measure in which the soul responds to grace, she keeps forming these links. The tragedy is if we just neglect it. And so in the next paragraph, he's going to be talking about a passport to grace. One of the things I love about these writings is that as things come, things are invented and come to be used by people, Jesus picks up the message and he uses the idea as well. So Jesus added, what is the passport to enter into the kingdom of grace? We all need passports to enter into kingdoms. He says it's humility. Through humility, by always looking at her nothingness and seeing that she is nothing but dust or wind, the soul will place all her trust in grace, so much so as to make it her master. And grace, taking dominion over all the soul, leads her along the path of all virtues and makes her reach the summit of perfection. That is the proper stature that we spoke about in the last paragraph. Now, for this humility or nothingness, I want to give you Psalm 8, verses 3 and 4. I want to give you Isaiah 57, 15. It's a beautiful text. I live in a high and holy place, but I reach down to those who are humble. I want to give you James 4, 6. But in these writings, Jesus is raising us higher than the normal spirituality that is in the church. The spirituality of the divine will is the highest spirituality. It is the crown of all sanctity. And therefore, the humility that was accepted in the past is not accepted for us. You can begin there. What is expected for us is something that he himself has invented, and that is the word nothingness. Nothingness is way beyond humility. If I'm humble, I will know it. And so if I'm humble and I know it, there's still something of me there. I remember reading a book about humility and it spoke about 13 degrees of humility. I gave up on the second one. I thought, no, this is only for heroic people. But the nothingness I don't have a problem with at all. There's something glorious about nothingness. Let's put it this way. If somebody hurts you and you are in your nothingness, there's nothing to hurt. So there's no problem. You literally don't have a problem. But if the ego is there and the ego thinks it's very important and everything, you know, it rises up and it gets all hurt and you have all kinds of problems and all the rest of it. So the nothingness is the safest place on the planet. And with the nothingness, we give God the space to be able to work with us. And we give him the freedom to work with us. It's the most wonderful thing. So we're going to hear more and more and more about this nothingness. But let me just jump to volume, I think it's 24. Where For people who think they're really flying high in the divine will spirituality, there's a little phrase that made the whole lot of us laugh when we read it. And that is that Jesus said, make sure your nothingness is really empty. And I thought, you know human nature. You absolutely do. Even with the nothingness, we can slip something in. So there's going to be a lot of emphasis on mortification, self-denial, nothingness, so that we are free. When we really, really arrive at nothingness, we are utterly free. Oh, it's amazing. It's a wonderful place to be. So you'll hear more about it. So I want to go on to the next paragraph. And this is the soul without grace. And you see, Jesus does this all the time. He will tell you the positive and he'll show you the negative so that the comparison helps you to make a choice. Now, in doing that, he is a superb teacher. Of course, he's the teacher. We all learned this in our teaching practice, that if you're to show something, if to show a student what something is, you'll do an awful lot better by showing them what it is not. And when they have the comparison, they don't have a difficulty with the revelation you're giving to them. So Jesus says, what would a soul without grace look like? I think it's Louisa that's talking. I'm not sure. It's Louisa. It seemed to me that she would be like the body without the soul, which becomes stinking and spews worms and rot from all parts. In other words, a carcass. So much so as to become an object of horror to the human sight. In the same way, without grace, the soul becomes so abominable as to be horrifying to the sight, not of men, but of our thrice holy God. Ah, Lord, Louisa said, free me from such a misfortune and from the abominable monster of sin. Now, those of us trying to live the divine will, spirituality, you've got to go to war 100% against sin. You can't join this spirituality at all if there's mortal sin in your soul. So that has to be dealt with long before you come to divine will spirituality. Deliberate venial sin, you cannot have the will of God ruling your life because you are deliberately rebelling against him. So at the very early stages of coming in contact with this material, we have to go to war with deliberate venial sin. What is deliberate venial sin? It is, I want to give you a piece of my mind. I want to get revenge. I want to hurt you. I want. It's the I want we've got to deal with. It's totally different to have involuntary sin. That does not block the divine will spirituality at all. And so involuntary sin could be that you say something nasty to me when I just happen to be at a point of weakness because of tiredness or illness or pain or whatever, and I react to you. But I did not want to react to you. It's not a voluntary thing. So if it's not voluntary, the Lord will show us how to get more and more and more control over our reactions. OK, it's a wonderful, wonderful journey we take. So Louisa said that sin is horrifying to the sight of God. I want to give you Habakkuk 1:13. It says, Lord, your eyes are too pure to look upon sin. I want to give you Hebrews 12:14. Nothing unholy or unworthy can enter the presence of God. I want to give you John 8:11. Anyone who sins is a slave. And I want to give you 1 John 5:17 to look up. So when we get into this battle with ourselves, the big trial that can come to us is discouragement. And that's the message of February the 4th, 1900, Volume 3. Discouragement is a great trial. I've been there, done that, and got the T-shirt, as we say. I don't recommend it to anybody. Please, if you can, avoid discouragement. It is an enormous trial. And getting out of discouragement is like trying to get out of a slimy pit without even shoes on your feet. You just keep slipping back. So I want to give you Isaiah 42:4. I want to give you Deuteronomy 1:21 and Colossians 3:21. Now, Louisa only has it in a short piece. I had it over years and it was unbelievably horrible. As I was in a state full of discouragement, especially because of the privation of my highest good, this morning, making himself seen for just a little, Jesus told me. Discouragement, he said, is an infectious mood, which infects the most beautiful flowers and the most pleasant fruits and penetrates down to the bottom of the root in such a way that by invading the whole tree, that infectious humour or mood renders it withered and squalid. Oh, I know what that feels like. And if one does not remedy it by watering it with a contrary mood or humour, since the bad humour has infiltrated deep into the root, it will make the root wither and the tree fall to the ground. Now, the tree is in the Bible sometimes used as an image of an individual person, as it sometimes is. But the tree is also used as an image of the church. Okay, so it happens to the soul who becomes soaked with this infectious humour of discouragement. And the problem in this crisis is a lack of confidence in God. In spite of all of this, Louisa said, I still felt discouraged. You see, that's what discouragement is. It's nearly impossible to get out of it. And she describes herself as all huddled within myself. And I saw myself as so bad I did not dare to fling myself towards my sweet Jesus. So she knows the solution and doesn't take it. My mind was occupied with the thought that it was useless for me to hope for his continuous visits as before, for his graces, for his charisms. Everything was over for me. And he, almost scolding me, said, what are you doing? What are you doing? Don't you know that the lack of confidence renders the soul moribund? That means about to die. It kills you. Thinking that she has to die, she no longer thinks of anything, neither of gaining anything or of making it circulate, nor of embellishing herself more, nor of remedying her sickness. She thinks of nothing else, but it's all over. It's all over. Forget about it. Sometimes they commit suicide. That's the problem with discouragement. It leads to despair. Okay. Ah, Lord, Louisa said, I imagine seeing this spectre or demon of the lack of confidence. It's squalid, emaciated, fearful, and all trembling. And all of his mastery, with no other ingenuity but fear alone, leads souls to their death. But what is more, this spectre does not show himself as an enemy, so that the soul may sneer at his fear, but he shows himself as a friend and infiltrates so sweetly into the soul that if the soul is not attentive, seeing him as a faithful friend who agonizes with her even and even dies together with her, she will hardly be able to free herself from his artificious mastery. Okay, so the Lord is going to show her how to come out of this. But the real solution is confidence in God. That you have confidence in God, not because you're good, it's because he's good. Not because you're loving, it's because he's loving. It's because he is love and he is merciful. You throw yourself on his mercy and you've got to keep doing it against all your feelings, against everything that's going on inside of you. You've got to keep affirming to him, I love you, I trust you, and you've got to learn to trust him beyond reason. I learned that in overcoming discouragement. Jesus told me to tell everybody on the planet that I spoke to that we are all to trust him beyond reason, regardless of what you see, regardless of what you hear, regardless of what you experience. Trust him beyond reason. And our model is our Blessed Mother standing at the foot of the cross, looking at her son disintegrating from the incredible torture that was given to him. And she trusted God beyond reason that he would rise from the dead. When it looked as if with this amount of destruction that had been brought into his body, that rising from the dead would be an act of creation. But an act of creation is nothing to God, nothing at all. And raising us from the death of our souls is nothing to him either. We just have to throw ourselves upon his mercy and trust him beyond reason, especially in all the crises that are coming to the church and the world. We must trust him beyond reason, please trust him beyond reason. And our problem today is that we like to rationalize everything. We like to bring it down to our puny little brains. And how much do we understand? We understand very little. So we have to trust God beyond reason. So I want to go to February the 5th, 1900. And the heading is that the circle of truth is the knowledge of self. In other words, you have to learn about your nothingness and you have to learn about confidence. These are the two things to keep you free. Okay. So Louisa says, continue in the same state, so she's still discouraged, but with a little bit more courage, though I wasn't perfectly free, my dearest Jesus on coming told me, my daughter, sometimes the soul feels an encounter with some virtue, and plucking up her strength, the soul overcomes the encounter. So in other words, if you have encountered discouragement, you've got to overcome it with confidence in God. And the overcomer is the one who is given the prize in the book of Revelation chapter 2. So for the overcomer, I want to give you Revelation 2, verse 7, 11, 17, etc. If you overcome this, if you overcome that, if you overcome the other, Jesus says you get all kinds of prizes in heaven. So he says, my daughter, sometimes the soul feels an encounter in some virtue, and plucking up her strength, the soul overcomes this encounter. And then that virtue becomes more resplendent and rooted in the soul. However, the soul must be very attentive in order to avoid that she herself might provide the little rope to let herself be bound by lack of confidence. In other words, we are our own worst enemies. And you can hang yourself on your own petard. You don't actually need anybody else to kill you. And so we have to be very careful that we don't set the trap for ourselves. And she will do this by always restricting herself within the circle of truth. Oh, wow. Without ever leaving it, which is the knowledge of her nothingness. And John 8:32 says, only the truth will set you free. And it's the knowledge of our nothingness. If someone tells you you're a sinner, so what? They're not giving you information you don't know. So if somebody wants to put you down, you're down. You're in your nothingness. They can't put you anywhere. You've already agreed to be nothing. It's fantastic. And once we have our nothingness and our confidence in God, that's it. You have your victory. Now, if you want to go somewhere to learn about confidence in God, go to St. Therese of Lisieux. She took out her PhD in confidence in God. And she trusted God beyond reason. And one of the things that Therese said to us is that you will receive from God exactly as much as you have confidence to receive. I think that's very interesting. If a child asks the parent for something and has no confidence that the parent loves them enough to give it to them, that doesn't stimulate the parent to give. But if the parent has absolutely no money whatsoever and the child comes with total confidence and love to the parent will jump over mountains to try and get the thing for the child because they've been touched so deeply by that confident love that you are my daddy or you are my mummy and you can do everything. And if we come to God with that simplicity of a child, we're fine, absolutely fine. So the warning comes in February the 12th, 1900, a very important message. And it is that voluntary sin is a huge block. You're not going anywhere with the divine will in this. So Louisa said, I was in a state of abandonment on the part of my adorable Jesus. I felt my poor heart crushed by the pain and under a press. So her state of abandonment isn't what we call, she says she's been abandoned by him and therefore she feels she's dying. Oh God, what an unutterable pain, she said. It's only in a higher volume I'll talk about the meaning of the privations because you're just getting it piece by piece here. So while I was in this state, she said, I saw my dear good almost like a shadow, but not clearly. I only saw one hand clearly, which seemed to carry a lamp with it. He dipped his finger in the lamp and anointed the area of my heart, embittered to the summit by the pain of his privation. And at that moment, I heard a voice saying, the truth is light, which the word brought upon the earth. Now, God is truth. God is light. The light is truth. The truth is light. John 14:6. And 1 John 1:5, God is light, in him there is no darkness. Okay. 1 John 1:5. So, just as the sun illuminates, vivifies and fertilizes the earth, so does the light of truth give life and light. Now, if you go to the first chapter of St. John, verses 4 and 5, Jesus is called the light of life. Okay. So just as the sun illuminates and vivifies and fertilizes the earth, so does the light of truth, which is God himself, give life and light. And it renders souls fertile with virtues. Even though many clouds block this light of truth, which are the iniquities of men, in spite of this, it does not cease to send forth glimmers of vivifying light from behind the clouds so as to warm souls. Now, what blocks the light of God's truth from coming through are the dense clouds which are formed by voluntary sin, great or small. And yet somehow the light can penetrate a little bit. As you know, on a very dark, rainy day, there's still light coming through the clouds. And if these clouds are clouds of imperfection and of involuntary effects, notice involuntary, okay, this light piercing them with its heat makes them vanish and it penetrates freely into the soul. So imperfections and involuntary sin is not a block to the Lord, not at all. So Louisa said, I understood that the soul must be attentive not to fall even into a shade of voluntary defects, which are those dangerous clouds that prevent the entrance of divine light. So again, I want to give you Hebrews 12:14. Nothing unholy or unworthy can enter the presence of God. I also want to give you Revelation 21:27. That when the New Jerusalem is established on the earth, only those in the will of God are in the New Jerusalem and all others are outside. So February the 13th, 1900, we come back to mortification again. It's lime for the soul. This morning, after receiving communion, I saw my adorable Jesus, but completely changed in his appearance. He seemed all serious and distant in the act of approaching me. What a tormenting change. Instead of being relieved, I felt my poor heart more oppressed, more pierced before such an unusual presence of Jesus. He usually comes to our all love. Yet I felt all the need for a relief from the pains of his privations suffered in the past days, which were such that I seemed to be alive but agonizing and in a continuous state of violence. But Blessed Jesus, wanting to reproach me because I was looking for relief in his presence, whereas I was called to look for nothing but suffering because she's a victim soul, he told me, just as lime has the power of cooking the objects which are thrown into it, so does mortification have the power of cooking all the imperfections and defects which are present in the soul. And it reaches the point of spiritualizing even the body, surrounding it like a circle and sealing all the virtues within it. Until mortification has cooked you well, both the soul and the body, to the point of undoing it, I will not be able to seal you perfectly with the mark of my crucifixion. Oh dear. Louise's mortification is that she must accept that Jesus is not coming the way she wants him to come. And she must stop all the lamenting for his loss. Now, it's going to take a bit of time to accomplish this. You see, the strange thing is, if I asked you what your cross was, you might say something, you know, quickly. But your cross is the thing that literally crucifies you. It's the thing you'd give to anybody, anywhere, anytime, under any condition, so long as they went away. That's what your cross is, because it's going to crucify you. And so we're only at volume 3, and yet Louisa is willing to take the crown of thorns. She's willing to suffer the crucifixion. It's partly because Jesus will be with her all the time, but never mind. But the biggest suffering she has is actually Jesus' absence. And she's not able to take it, and she's not willing to take it. It's beautiful to see it. I love to see the saints struggling, because it gives us the courage, those of us who are not saints and who desperately need to know it's okay to struggle. And that's why I make much of Louise's struggle, to comfort the rest of us and to encourage the rest of us to continue and to understand why you struggle. Because this is why this material is given to us. It's not given to us to say something about Louisa. It's given to us to tell us what to do when we ourselves are struggling. And so Louisa sometimes, very briefly, can put up with his privation and offer it to him as an act of love. But most of the time she complains and she says, "You don't love me." You know, it's not actually possible for God not to love us. But what she meant was, you're not coming the way you came before. Now, you and I, who have not had these incredible mystical experiences that Louisa has, and we don't have Jesus coming to us in a three-dimensional form every single day, have not the faintest idea of the pain of his absence. So during our prayer life, if we have a time of dryness in prayer, we just put up with it. We don't have the soul-searching, destroying, soul-destroying pain that she has. And so we can't understand it. But gradually, as we go along in the volumes, the Lord will reveal to us what is actually going on, and will help us to understand. And as we go along, we ourselves will be growing. And therefore, I just want to give it to you piece by piece, as the Lord gave it to us piece by piece, and not give you something from the higher volumes that you mightn't be ready for right now. So in the next paragraph, a longish paragraph, Louisa discovers that she has to make mortification her friend. And she makes a lovely confession that makes me love her and want to hug her. So after this, Louisa said, "Someone, I can't really tell who it was, but it seemed to be an angel, pierced my hands and my feet through. And Jesus, with a lance which came out from his heart, pierced mine to an extreme pain. Then he disappeared, leaving me more afflicted than before. So Jesus came, pierced her with a lance. She was looking for comfort. Okay. And left her more afflicted than before. "Oh, how well I understood the necessity of mortification," she said, "my inseparable friend. And how there was not even a shadow of friendship in me for mortification." I love that. I think it's fantastic. "Ah, Lord, bind me yourself," Louisa said, "with indissoluble friendship to this good friend, mortification, because on my own I can only show myself to be all coarse." And she, not letting herself, she now is mortification, not seeing herself being welcomed nicely, uses all regards with me and keeps sparing me, fearing that I may come to the point of turning my back on her completely. So mortification never accomplishes with me her beautiful and majestic crafting, because as long as we remain a little distant, her prodigious hands cannot reach me in order to be able to work me, and to present me to you as a work worthy of your most holy hands. You need to read that over and over again and ask the Lord to somehow open your heart as distinct from opening your eyes. And I want to give you Ephesians chapter 2, verse 10. We are God's work of art, created in Christ Jesus. And so if you take on this divine will spirituality seriously, the Lord is going to exercise your will. He's going to have people go against your will, do things you don't want. And you're going to have to take your little motto, "Not my will, but thine be done," as your daily motto. And the more you will say it, the easier the mortification will become, because he will allow people to cross you, and he'll do it deliberately, so as to give you an opportunity to exercise the giving of your will to him. Okay, so February the 16th, 1900, we're still on mortification. Mortification must be the breath of the soul. So Louisa says it continues the same. "This morning, after renewing in me the pains of the crucifixion, Jesus said, mortification must be the very breath of the soul. Just as breathing is necessary to the body, and depending on the air it breathes, whether good or bad, it becomes infected or purified. And also, from the breathing, it can be known whether the interior of man is healthy or sick, and whether all the vital parts are in harmony. It's the same for the soul. If she breathes the air of mortification, everything in her will be purified. All of her senses will be sound with the same, will sound with the same concordant sound." In other words, all her senses will be in harmony. "If then she does not breathe the air of mortification, everything will be discordant in the soul. There will be no harmony. She will emit a stinking, disgusting breath. While she is about to tame one passion, another one will unbridle itself. In sum, her life will be nothing but a child's game. That means there will be no spiritual maturity. There will be no victories." And so Louisa said, "I seem to see mortification like a musical instrument. If the strings are all good and strong, it produces a harmonious and pleasant sound. But if the strings are not good, you now have to fix one and then tune another one all the time. Therefore, all the time is spent on fixing and never playing." That's very interesting. You just don't get your act together and be able to go on spiritually, on to greater things. You're forever at the beginning. "At the most, it will produce a discordant and unpleasant sound, so nothing good will ever be accomplished." So here we are in the middle of volume 3, and the Lord is telling us if we don't get the mortification thing right, we're not going anywhere. On February the 19th, 1900, the Lord begins to speak about pride. Pride is the biggest block between us and God. And the problem with pride is we find it very difficult to see it in ourselves. We find it easy to see it in other people. And so Jesus speaks about the 20th century as the century of pride. Very interesting. So I want to add onto that, it was the century of deception. And I want to give you a number of references before we even begin. 1 John 2:16, 1 Timothy 3:6, Mark 7:22, Isaiah 28:1, not given in any order of merit or anything, just given. This morning, Louisa said, my adorable Jesus came and transported me outside of myself. So I want to give you Amos 3:7. The Lord is going to deal with Louisa as a prophet because he shows her what is to come. I could see many people all in motion. I can't tell with certainty, but there seemed to be a war. Now, it's 1900. And Louisa is told about World War I for years before it happens so that she can make reparation and the thing can be toned down a bit. She's going to learn all about World War II before it happens. And when World War II actually happens, Jesus says nothing to her about it. All he says is that they want to kill each other, let them at it, but let you and I create a future full of hope for them. So he gets her to look to the future when this desperate chastisement is actually happening. In the book of Revelation, we're given three waves of terrifying chastisements. And it seems to be that we're talking about three world wars. I think it's kind of generally accepted now that World War I was the first great chastisement in the book of Revelation. World War II was the second one. And the one that's coming is World War III. So what would cause them? So she said, it seemed to be a war or a revolution, and they did nothing but braid crowns of thorns for our Lord. So much so that while I was all intent on removing one, they would drive a more painful one into his head. Yes, it really seemed that this century of ours, that's the 20th century, will be renowned for its pride. I want to give you Psalm 10:2 and Psalm 73:6. The greatest misfortune, Louisa says, is to lose one's head. Because once the head with the brain is lost, all the other members become disabled. Or they become one's own enemies and the enemies of others. The head is the head of the person in pride, or the head of a people in pride. So it happens that a person gives vent to all other vices. You see, pride is the first of the seven deadly sins and opens the door to them all. My patient Jesus tolerated all these crowns of thorns, and I hardly had the time to remove them. And then he turned to them, to this crowd, and said, you will die. Some in war, some in jail, some from earthquakes, and only a few of you will be left. So I want to give you Proverbs 11:12. God resists the proud and always favours the humble. I want to give you Isaiah chapter 2, verses 9, 11 and 17, in which the prophet says at least three, if not four times in this chapter, that the pride of man must be brought low if God is going to be able to rule on the earth. For earthquakes, I want to give you Isaiah 2:19. Few of you will be left. That is few of that particular generation. Pride has formed the course of the actions of your lives, and pride will give you death. There's Proverbs 11:2, Proverbs 16:18 and Proverbs 29:23. That's your homework. After this, blessed Jesus pulled me away from those people, and as he became a baby, I carried him in my arms to give him rest. Asking me for a refreshment, that's usually reparation, he wanted to suckle from me. Fearing that it might be the devil, I signed him with the cross several times. Now, when Jesus appears as an infant, he sometimes suckles from Louisa. Now, this is only volume 3, and she will eventually explain that he's actually drawing from her heart. It's not a physical thing. She's in an out-of-the-body experience. And very often she suckles from him, or he pours milk into her. Now, you know that milk for an infant is life and all the nourishment for life. And so what Louisa will eventually be able to explain is that when she draws life from him, he is able to then draw life from her, because it's the life that he gave to her that he gets from her. In other words, the circle is complete. But Louisa gives it in very graphic language, as if it was happening physically. So she's afraid that it mightn't be Jesus. And I think this is very funny. She asks him to recite the Hail Mary with her to our Blessed Mother. Now, Jesus only says the first part, because Jesus doesn't need to say, Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners. That's us. Okay. And so he recited the first part, which I think is beautiful. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with you. Wow, it's fantastic. And so Louisa said the second half, which represents us. Then he himself wanted to recite the Our Father, which is different. That's his own prayer, in which he glorifies the Father on behalf of us all. It's fantastic. And asks for the kingdom to come and for the divine will to be done on the earth. Oh, how touching it was, his praying was, Louisa said. It was so moving that my heart seemed to liquefy. And he added, Daughter, unlike others, I lived my life from the heart. That means from love. Love was the only reason for his existence. Love was the only motive for anything that he did. Why? Because God is love. Love is everything to him. And the point is, the only baggage you're allowed in death is love. The only thing you can take to heaven with you is love. All the rest, leave it behind. And the problem is that the people today who have loaded themselves with sins and have no love, they're going to be in a bad way when they go to the other side. Love is the only baggage allowed. So he said, I lived from the heart. And this is one reason why I am all heart for souls. And I am inclined to want the heart. This is Deuteronomy 6:4-10. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one Lord. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your being. And later on, they added, and love your neighbor as yourself. It's all about love. In fact, you've started on a journey of studying the writings of Louisa Picaretta. There are 36 volumes. And the summary of the 36 volumes is this: divine will and love. God is love. The divine will is the essence of God. So it's all about love. If we don't take out our PhD in love, we've missed the bus. In fact, we've missed the bus, the boat, the train and everything else. So he said, I'm inclined to want the heart. I'm inclined to want love. And I tolerate not even a shadow of what is not mine. That is in those who give themselves to him. Because he can only have what is pure and holy and spiritual. The mud and the material stuff means nothing to him. So that's your Hebrews 12:14 again. So between you and me, I want everything distinctly for myself, because God is a jealous lover. And that which you will concede to creatures will be nothing but the overflow of our love. So John 7:37 to 39, Jesus said, "If you truly believe in me, come and drink, and then out of your own heart will flow fountains of living water for others." So we become a source of life for others only when we drink deeply from the well of salvation. So I want to leave it there for now, and we'll take it up another time.